This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today is Carol Burnett.
What brings you to Tara?
You fixin' you, starlet. I love you. That gown is gorgeous.
Thank you. I saw it in the window and I just couldn't resist it.
That's Carol as Starlet O'Hara, making a grand entrance wearing a set of curtains as a dress with the rod still attached. Harvey Korman is smitten as Captain Rat Butler in this Gone with the Wind parody on The Carol Burnett Show. The chemistry between the players on this show, Burnett, Korman, and also Vicki Lawrence, Tim Conway, and Lyle Waggoner, is legendary. The show ran for 11 seasons. The first 5 seasons have been recently released on DVD. They haven't been seen since airing over 40 years ago.
It is incredible, and you see them, and it's the first time we did the soap opera takeoff, the first time, Vicki and her, when we started out, and we were pretty raw. Pretty raw.
Well, we're going to get to that, because when I watched the show, I saw so many little tells and so many little things about how you guys crack each other up, obviously.
Oh, yes.
And there's things you guys do to each other.
I know.
And you can just see you almost with joy and almost loathing that they're, like, you're kind of torturing each
other. It's like getting the giggles in church.
Yes.
You know, but Alec, when we started the show, I wanted to do it as a live show. We couldn't really do it live because the studio, which I love that studio because it was like...
Is that a TV City?
TV City, Studio 33, which is like a little theater. You know, it's like proscenium and the seats are down. It's not like the tiered things that you have, other shows, you know. And so I loved that, but we couldn't, there were no flies in the theater. By that, I mean where you could fly the scenery in and out and really do a live show. But I wanted it to go fast because we had a studio audience there, and I couldn't stand to keep them waiting because if they get bored and sit there for a long time while we take our time changing clothes and so forth, we lose them.
Right.
So we lose that energy
momentum
and enthusiasm that you get when an audience is hot. So I would have a bet with the stagehands that I could do a skin-out change faster than they could move that sofa across the room. And also, I didn't want to stop and do pickups. If something went wrong, I figured, you know, unless the scenery fell down and knocked us out in the head, I wanted to keep going. So when somebody would ad-lib or do a bit that we had not done before, we never broke up on purpose. Ever.
Right.
Ever. I just said, well, let's roll.
But it was
with
understood
it.
That you would ad lib. It was understood that that was.
We never said it. It just started happening. So we just let it go.
Who was the bad boy in church usually?
Tim Conway.
I was going to say, he seemed like. Do you have comedy insurance? He asks.
Wasn't that brilliant
God,
when he
believe.
Said it? Yeah. Yeah, because Harvey was trying to put him on, and then Tim came up and topped him. I don't suppose you have comedy insurance down there, do you? Yeah, it was brilliant.
I don't believe when you watch these shows, your lost episodes, so that audiences from our show understand that it was 67 through 78.
Correct.
Those 11 years. And the first 5 years... are the shows you're referring to as the lost episodes. And when you see, so this is the crowd young.
Yes.
And you see over 11 years, people get older.
Yes.
Harvey has a nice kind of auburn color to his hair. And then Harvey has like a steel color to his hair.
And Vicki.
And Vicki grows older. And everybody, not in any bad way, but everybody, well, 11 years is a long time. You don't see that on TV anymore.
We matured.
But I will say, with all sincerity, that I don't think you'd have to go to Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, in my mind, to find someone who is as trim and fit and lithe as you on stage. You never had to exercise a day in your life. The show was your workout.
That's
things
true.
You do. When you're scissoring your way across the floor during the fire scene because you think the fire is happening, I look at you, I go, my God, look at this woman, what she's doing to herself. Was it physically...
as demanding as it seemed?
I never felt that.
You didn't?
No. You're just
in it.
Well, you know, the adrenaline starts pumping when you're performing and everything. And I'm really not that lithe. I mean, I still can't touch my toes without bending my knees. I'm not that good. But I was able to do a lot of stunts and things like that. I don't know. I just threw myself into it.
Yeah, you don't think about it when you're doing it.
And I never hurt myself. I got a few bruises here and there once in a while, but I never broke a bone. I'm jumping out of windows, falling downstairs.
Yeah. Crashing through doors with Burt Reynolds.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and there you do that exit with Burt Reynolds. I mean, I always joke with people and say, when I was young and I was younger, I was pretty fit.
Uh-huh.
I said, now I'm older, and I probably could do some of those things again, but it's more my doubts or more of my concerns about it. I say to somebody, like in my real life, I might not be as physically engaged as I was, but if you pay me $2 million, I can still run down the street with a gun in my hand.
That's funny.
It's always funny. I can do it if the character's doing it.
If I'm
saving a baby from climbing into a well.
I totally agree. And in fact, I never knew sometimes how I was going to do a character until I got into the outfit.
Interesting.
I worked from the outside in. You know, some actors work from the inside out. Right. There were lots of times I had no idea what I was going to do until I went into the costume fitting and saw what Bob Mackie had created for me.
How did that union with him and that collaboration with him begin? Where did you first meet Bob?
Well, when we were getting ready to do the show, and we said, you know, costuming is going to be really important because the costume designer isn't going to just design for me. That costume designer is going to design for every body you see on the screen, dancers, singers, guest stars, rep company, everything you see has to be coordinated by the one person. So we had seen Alice in Wonderland on television. I remember Carol Channing was the Queen of Diamonds or Hearts or something like that, but fantastic, wonderful costuming. And then I'd seen Mitzi Gaynor, I think was in Vegas. And aside from the gorgeous gowns she wore, she also did a lot of fall down humor and, you know, fat suits and crazy outfits and so forth. And the common denominator was Bob Mackie. Mm. And we said, you know, we've got to meet Bob Mackie and see if maybe, you know, he would be the one. So we got in touch with him. And he came over to our house, bing bong. I opened the door, and there stood this guy that looked like he was 12 years old.
Yeah.
Just fresh and adorable. And he came in, he was about 25 years old. And we just liked him right away. We knew he had the talent. So we hired him right then on the spot. And it was one of the best decisions
we
ever made.
When you say we, who was we?
My husband.
Talk about your husband.
Well, Joe Hamilton, right, was the producer of the Gary Moore Show. That's right, where we met. And so when I was going to do my show, of course, he was going to be the producer. So we were...
And you were on Broadway?
I had been, and then we moved to California.
How was that for you?
Moving to California?
Yeah.
Well,
ready?
I was raised there.
Right. Oh.
Yeah, I was raised in...
By your grandmother?
In Hollywood.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew you grew up in San Antonio.
No, I grew up. I was 7 years old.
And you left.
And then we left and moved to Hollywood.
You had a granny's house.
That's right.
Where in Hollywood?
A one-room apartment, one block north of Hollywood Boulevard.
The one that, now this is, you pulled on your ear.
Yeah, that was
to say hi to her.
Say hello to her, yes, yeah.
And where was she at the end of her life? Still in California?
She was still in California.
Did she come and see?
Well, she died before I got my show.
Oh.
But she had seen me do the Gary Moore Show and the Ed Sullivan Show and so forth.
Was she just thrilled by what you accomplished?
Oh, yeah. Well, at first, when I got the chance to go to New York from California, because I wanted to be on Broadway. I wanted to be Ethel Merman, Mary Martin, you know, that. And she was not for it. She said, your blood's too thin. You'll be dead in a week in New York.
Why do you think she said that?
She didn't want me to go.
She was trying to talk you out of it.
Yeah.
She didn't want to lose you.
Correct.
To show business.
Correct.
To the Sodom and Gomorrah of show business.
Well, she just didn't want me to be away from her.
To leave her.
Her. But when I got my first show, it was a Paul Winchell Kitty TV show. I auditioned and I got a gig on that. And I called Nanny and I said, Nanny, I'm going to be on Paul Winchell's show Saturday. And she said, well, say hello to me. And I said, Nanny, I don't think they're going to let me say, hi,
exactly.
Nanny.
Right, exactly.
Yes. So we figured out I'd pull my
the
ear,
code.
Which meant, hi, Nanny, I love you. And then later when I got successful, it meant, hi, Nanny, I love you. Your check's on the way.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you go, how would you describe when you're on Gary Moore's show? You're one of a company.
Yes.
And you come to Los Angeles to do your show.
Mm-hmm.
And you're part of a company, but you're not just part of a company. You're the star of the show. It's your show.
However, I remember Gary Moore, and I learned a lot from him. He was so wonderful. And it was his show, the Gary Moore Show, and it was a very popular variety, comedy variety show. And Durward Kirby was a sidekick.
Durward Kirby.
Durward and me and Marion Lauren were the second bananas. But he never treated us as second bananas. For instance, Alec, we would come in on a Monday to read the script for that week. And he'd look at it, and he'd have a joke or something. He'd say, you know, I can't, give this joke to Durward. He can do it better than me. Or give this line to Carol. She can say it funnier than I can. So it was a true rep company, and that's what I learned about my show.
Moore set a good example
he
for you.
He set a true, you know, so his name was on it, but we were a true rep company. My name was, you know, at the head of it. We were a true rep company, because when that happens and you don't want to hog it, you know, the show gets better. You give it to Tim. You give it
to
Harvey.
Ball,
you
give
it
to whoever's got the hot hand.
Who's got, yeah, and do it, you know.
Harvey.
Oh, you know, years ago when I was doing the Gary Moore show, one of the guests that week, one week, was Ed Wynn.
Right.
You know, the old wonderful vaudevillian comedian. And so we were sitting around lunch one day, and he was regaling us with stories and stuff. And he said, he started to talk about the difference between a comic and a comedic actor. And Gary said, what is it? He said, well, a comic says funny things like Bob Hope. A comedic actor like Jack Benny says things funny.
Wow.
Is that good?
So Joe, your husband,
yes.
And you get out to L.A., mm-hmm. You start to do the show. Who's in charge creatively? Who's the final word creatively?
We both.
You and your husband.
We both.
It's
were.
You and
I
Joe.
Mean, we, yeah, we talked
about
who
cast the show. Where did you find them?
Well, Harvey was on the Danny Kaye show. Danny had a comedy variety show, and Harvey was his.
How many years did Kaye's show run?
You know, I don't know, five,
yeah. Yeah, a
six,
few.
Something like, yeah.
More than two.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was going to go off the air. And we had seen his show and loved the show. And we said, this Harvey Korman is just sensational. It's like Carl Reiner to Sid Caesar and Art Carney to Jackie Gleason. You know, we wanted to get a rep company. We said, oh, my God. And Danny's show was going off the air when we were going on. We said, let's get Harvey Korman. So that's what we did. I practically attacked him in a parking lot at CBS. You know, I think we'd already called his agent, but I ran into him. I wasn't in a car, but I ran into him in the parking lot at CBS, and I just grabbed him. I said, you got to be on my show. You got to be on my show. So we got him. And
Tim.
Well, Tim wasn't a regular at the get-go.
He recurred.
We had him on maybe twice a month or something until, finally the penny dropped, and we hired him in the ninth year for every single week.
And was it something you just hadn't considered? Or he wasn't available? He didn't want to sign on?
Well, he had done a couple of other shows. But in the meantime, he had a variety show that didn't work, and he had a comedy Western that was filmed, which was a big mistake because Tim needs to be in front of an audience. You know, I have a funny story about his cancellation for this one. It's the funniest cancellation story I've ever heard. He was doing this show called Rango, and it was he was this inept cowboy, and it was filmed, and it was not very good. So he's in the motorhome after they'd done one scene one day, and he's changing and putting on his boots and stuff like that, and there's a knock on the door. And it was an underling, actually, from ABC who was sent to tell him that the show was canceled. But he was nervous, and he said, I'm Warren Tart or somebody from ABC, Mr. Conway. And Tim said, well, hi, how are you? What can I do for you? And the guy said, stop doing this.
You could pack up your dressing room.
Stop doing this.
Oh, my goodness.
He just didn't. He took off his boots and went home. In fact, every show he'd done only ran about 13 weeks because that was the norm then, and then it was canceled. So at one point, he had a license plate that said 13 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
But what a genius.
Who was the woman? You're in a sketch, and it was maybe one of the one with the French revolutionary sketch.
Nanette Fabre.
She was
on our show 19 times.
Can you believe that?
She's still with us. Nanny's she's in her 90s now.
Oh,
and she was wonderful to work with. Absolutely wonderful.
You're talking to someone who, you know, back then show business was show business. You did Broadway, mm-hmm. you did sitcoms and variety shows like yours, the old great variety shows that you don't see as much anymore. You did game shows.
Mm-hmm. Password.
Alan Ludden.
Yes.
You saw Gene Rayburn with that antenna-like microphone.
The Match Game. Richard Dawson was so smart.
Richard Dawson.
Oh, my gosh.
And who was the one that was Klugman's wife?
Brett.
Brett Summers.
Brett.
Those people. Because
yeah.
You knew they all had like a flask underneath
of
the
course.
Desk. They were having a drink.
Of course.
It was a party.
Well, they did that with Hollywood Squares.
Hollywood Squares.
They would have Paul breaks Lind. And everybody would get snockered.
Exactly. Yeah. We would do Paul Lind in my house to harass my mother. I had a childhood that was just immersed. It was just awash in this comedy. I watched you. I watched Gleason. I watched Alan Funt. I mean, I'm a kid born in 1958, uh-huh. grew up in the 60s watching TV, pretty much abandoned TV after that. And then I go and I go to acting school, and of course everyone wants to do O'Neill and Chekhov and Ibsen, and we all want to plumb the depths of our soul, and rightfully so. But then I do a sitcom, and I realize I'm stealing from all those people that I saw.
Yeah.
And no one more than Corman.
Oh.
No one more than him. And he is so talented.
Oh, he was wonderful.
His timing mm-hmm. and his tone. He could
Zachary Scott in Mildred Pierce. You know, unbelievable how smarmy he was. And he channeled Clark Gable. I mean, I swear. He didn't know how he was. He was so nervous that week when we were going to do Went with the Wind. And he said, I can't do Gable. But the minute he got into the drag, he became, again, what I was talking about. He became.
The costume led the way.
Yeah. And that wig and the mustache and the whole outfit and everything, he became Clark Gable.
The show is, of course, I want to talk about it in terms of not how things have changed, because I think people beat that to death a little bit. But, I mean, you're a woman. It's your show. And did everybody treat you the way you wanted to be treated back then? Or was it all like, yeah, sure, honey, put Joe on the phone?
That's about right.
They did.
Well, it was my doing, too. You know, in that era, the only one who really would speak up was Lucy. She was very strong.
Right.
But it's not in my nature to
take over,
confront,
right.
or anything. You know, like if a sketch wasn't working or something, instead of like Gleason or Sid would say, look, guys, this stinks. Now, come on, you got to fix it. But, you know, they would do that. I would say, I'd call the writers down into the rehearsal hall, and I'd say, you know, guys, I'm not doing this too well. Do you think maybe you could help me out with a different line here or there? Because, you know, otherwise I would have been a bitch in their
you
eyes.
You felt that way.
You know, and I, yeah. And I,
who hired the writers?
Joe.
How many writers did you have?
Well, we had about 7 for the comedy, and we had 3 special material writers who did all the original music and songs and medley right. and finales and so forth.
Like SNL has. They have a music department.
Right. And so that was fine. But I would have a say, and I'd walk into the writer's room. Arnie Rosen was our head writer. And I'd say, you know, I'd love to do Mildred Pierce. Can we do Mildred Pierce someday? Or I want to do Postman Always Rings Twice. Double Indemnity. African Queen.
Yeah.
Love Story. All of those.
Dial Him for Murder.
You got. Well, we never did that. Let me go back and do that one.
Yeah.
You know, and so they would do that. But I did dream a sketch once. I dreamed.
Can you say it on the air what sketch was?
Sure. It was, I dreamed it and we put it on the air. I was in a shower I mean, the door covered me, you know, and the water was coming down, and I was, you know, getting wet and washing, and I'm singing. Well, the moment I wake up, ba-ba-ba-da-da-da, dream a little dream of you, and I'm singing, the band is playing, so forth, and then I turn the water off, get a towel, kind of dry off, wrap it around myself, open the door, exit, and the camera pans in, and there are three musicians in tuxedos playing. Right.
Ringing
wet.
Your band is there.
It worked.
Oh, fantastic.
It was very funny.
So you had those writers, and how much writing did you do?
Did it expand
over the years where you became more confident?
Well,
so how about this and how about this?
Well,
you pitched?
We wrote on our feet. When we'd get the sketch, we'd start to rehearse, and Harvey would say, you know, I just feel like saying this instead of that. So he'd do it. I would do it. Tim, so forth. And I have to compliment our writers. They never complained. They came down, and if it was funny and working, they said, great, keep it in.
Carol tells a story about her friend, Lucille Ball, addressing the writers of The Lucy Show when the pilot wasn't working. Lucy wasn't afraid to speak her mind. She told her kid, that's when they put the S on the end of my last name. Explore the Here's the Thing archives. I talk with Kristen Wiig, who early on preferred her scenes unscripted.
For some reason, it was less scary to me than having words in front of me. Because I think when you're handed a script, you know that you're supposed to do it in a certain way, and people will think, like, how is she reading this? But when you're improvising, there's nothing to compare it to, and you can do whatever.
There's no Blanche DuBois.
Yeah, no.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. The Carol Burnett Show was an ensemble show that welcomed the biggest stars of television and film as its guests. Burt Reynolds, Jerry Lewis, Phyllis Diller, the Jackson 5, Cher, everyone wanted to work with Carol.
That was what we talked about, you know, at the get-go. I said, you know, aside from having a rep company, I want to have guest stars. But I don't want to have a guest star, say like a Steve Lawrence, who would come on and just sing a song and maybe we'd see him next in the finale. I wanted to integrate everybody into the show. So many times, I mean, almost every sketch, almost every guest star we had, we put in sketches. So they were throughout the show.
They were a member of the company.
Yeah, correct. And so that's certainly what Burt was.
And without naming names, when people came on, were some better than others?
Yes.
What did you do when they came on? Did you just kind of diminish their role on the show?
They were all pretty good, but some were...
So you guys had a nose for that.
Fabulous. Steve Lawrence is one of the funniest human beings in the world.
Wow.
And hysterical. And he was one of my favorite sketch performers. We did Postman, Always Drinks Twice. We did African Queen together. We did Double Indemnity together. We did From Here to Eternity together. I mean, and he was brilliant. And so when we first went into syndication many years ago, we had to cut all the music out. So it was only a half hour in syndication of the sketches because of cost of clearances and all of that. So Steve, of course, all of his music was cut out and stuff, so forth. But one time, during this time, he and Edie were in an airport one day, and these teenage girls ran up to him and said, "You're that funny guy on the Burnett Show."
Oh, wow.
And he used to say, "If you're long, cut my song. Don't cut the sketch.
Don't cut the sketch.
Cut my song.
Yeah. I can sing anytime.
Yeah.
But I can't do this anytime."
Right.
Who were some of the other ones that came on that you...
Ken Berry. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Corporal Agard.
Sing, dance, he was incredible.
He's a showman.
Well, he's a great dancer, great hoofer. And he sings, and he's funny. He was adorable. And so we used him a lot. Bernadette Peters was the first.
When she was a kid.
She was the first person we signed. She wasn't on our very first show, but she was the first person we asked to be on our show.
Who was someone that surprised you?
Oh, gosh.
If you can remember. Who was a movie star maybe that came on and surprised you?
Betty Grable.
No.
We had Betty on, because I was raised in the 40s, and so, you know, she was my favorite movie star. And so I was thrilled when we got her on the show. She was funny, very fun, very sharp, funny, wonderful sense of humor. And at the same time on that show was Martha Raye. So we had Betty Grable and Martha Raye. And that was the first time we ever did the soap opera As the Stomach Turns. And it was they were in it.
Yeah.
Your show plays during a time of incredible political upheaval in the country, the late 60s and the early 70s.
Right.
It doesn't get any more tumultuous.
Pretty
than
heavy,
that.
Yeah.
And was that something that you cast an eye toward, or did you decide to ignore it completely?
Well, I don't know if it was a decision to ignore it, but we just didn't do it.
Right. Nothing political.
No, because I don't know. I'm a clown.
Right.
And I just wanted to
I'm going to ask you about that.
I just want belly laughs.
Right.
That's what I wanted, you know, like a Sid Caesar. You know, I loved his show.
Right.
And so that's really
Do you consider yourself a comic or a comedic actor?
Comedic actor.
Right, exactly. Because for you, that range, I want to get back to the Vietnam era thing. But for you, you see you come in, and of course, the wardrobe and the wig and the eyebrows make it in Mildred Fierce.
Right.
The moment you walk in.
Yeah.
But also, you have that core of Joan oozing out of you when you walk on.
Oh, I just,
And then you dump out of it, and you can go from one extreme to the other, and then you're a clown, and then you're doing voices, and the character's collapsing in that way, and kind of
You know, in the family sketch, Eunice and Mama and Ed, you know, Well, we did about 35 of those, and one time we had Maggie Smith on the show, and so the sketch was with the family, Maggie Smith. Was a school teacher, and she called Eunice and Ed and Mama in to talk about the fact that Eunice and Ed's son was a bully. Bubba was, you never saw him, but was a bubba in school, and she wanted to discuss it with us. Well, during the course of the sketch, she discovers why poor Bubba is that way. It's because of this horribly dysfunctional family, right? So I don't know whose idea it was in rehearsal. Might have been Harvey's, might have been mine, I don't know. We decided just as an acting experiment, let's not do it as these characters. Let's do this sketch as if it's a one act. And so we did it. We didn't go over the top with the screeching and all of that. We did it very straight. Now, those sketches never had jokes in them. They were all about character. So when we did that, it was devastating. It was like doing a very serious one act when Eunice is trying to defend her role as a mother. It was very, very serious. So that was really great writing. And then we topped it off with the way we talked and all of that, screaming like that and all that. Yeah. And then it became funny. It was a great piece of writing and a great acting experiment. We just did it in rehearsal.
Now, to go back to that period, so your own politics didn't enter into the show or your husband's?
No.
And you were better off for that?
I think so, because now, you know, when we're seeing stuff, it holds up even though it's 40 years old because it's not topical.
Right.
You know, so in a way that was a blessing. We almost didn't get on the air because CBS didn't want us.
Explain that. They didn't want what?
Me to do a variety show.
They didn't want a variety show, or they didn't want you?
They didn't want me to do a variety show.
And they made that clear to Joe?
Oh, well, what happened was when I left the Gary Moore show, I signed a 10-year contract with CBS. And there was a strange clause in the first 5 years of the contract.
I remember this.
Was that if I wanted to do an hour-long variety show, all I had to do was push the button, and CBS would have to put on 31-hour pay-or-play variety shows with me.
Yeah.
So
in Hollywood, they call that the Burnett Clause, which means that's never happening again.
That's true. Right. And so I thought, I would never exercise that clause. Well, 5 years were almost up. There was a week left. And I hadn't been working, and we just bought a house or put a down payment on a house in California. We had two little babies. And Joe and I looked at each other and said, yeah, we better push that button. It was the last week. There were a lot of between Christmas and New Year's. So I called. We were in California, and I called the vice president here. I said, hi. He said, oh, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. How are you? I said, well, I'm calling to push that button. And he'd totally forgotten. He had no idea what I was talking about. And then they called me back the next day. He said, Carol, you know, it's not for gals. Comedy Variety is a man's game. They wanted me to do a sitcom where I would play Agnes. And I said, I don't want to be the same person week after week. I want to do this. And they had to put us on the air. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about this now.
You partnered with your then husband.
Yes.
But you didn't stay married to him.
We were married for almost 20 years.
Right, and you got divorced.
Yes.
But during the time you were married, that was a good thing.
We were doing the show, yeah.
You were doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you're doing a show with your husband.
Mm-hmm.
Day in, day out with your husband.
Mm-hmm.
See, I love that idea. And yeah. Some people think that's anathema to them. They never want to do that.
Well,
what was that like?
Well, I kind of let him.
To the extent you want to say.
I let him be the boss.
Right. And he protected you.
Yeah, he totally protected me.
I hope so.
And, you know, I could just come in and have fun.
Right. He let you.
He worked with the writers and the this and the that. You know, the time that I would work with the writers was when we were staging it. And that's when.
Did he think you were funny?
Yes.
Did you crack him up?
I'm not really that way in person. As they say, in real life.
Right.
Don't you love that term?
In real life.
What's somebody like in real life? I'm very kind of quiet.
And was he funny?
Yeah, he had a great sense of humor.
But he wasn't a performer in any way.
Well, he actually was a member of the Skylarks, which was a...
I have no idea what that is.
Okay, the Skylarks was a great musical group, like the Hi-Los and so forth, you know. And he started out writing special material, music material for the Dinah Shore Show years ago.
Wow. You know, your show was done in a different era in terms of standards and practices.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Did you sit there sometimes and go, ew?
No. They left us alone.
They left you alone.
We had
When you stick that sword in Harvey Korman's crotch, what did they say about that?
It was an accident.
was it an accident?
Oh, yes.
You.
Oh, you. No, one time, though, we had this wonderful censor that sat and, you know, Charlie Petty John, God bless him, and he was a hoot. We just loved him. Anyway, he never bothered with anything. So Harvey and I were doing a sketch where I was a nudist, and I was being interviewed by him, like Edward R. Murrow, you know, and I'm behind a fence that says keep out, and I'm bare-shouldered, and I'm leaning on the fence, bare legs with high-top sneakers on. So it was jokes about a nudist colony, right? So one of the lines was Harvey said, so tell me, how do you nudists, what do you do for recreation? And my line was, well, we have dances every Saturday night, you know. And he said, oh, how do you nudists dance? And my line was, very carefully. Well, for some reason, the higher-ups, Charlie didn't mind that line. They said, no, that's too suggestive.
Yeah.
Come up with something else.
Yeah.
Are you ready? So this is what we came up with, and this is what went on the air. So what do? Well, we have dances every Saturday night. Well, how do you nudists dance? Cheek to cheek.
Right. I know. Is that any better?
And they let
that go.
And that was funnier.
You know, there's material that gets revived, and it comes up in none more so than Annie.
Oh.
And you are the Miss Hannigan, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, thank you.
And who directed that film?
John Huston.
What was that like for you?
Well, it's very funny. You know, he was not really into musicals.
Right. Right.
And
that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. I have a theory. Ray Stark produced it.
Of course.
Okay. And I have a theory. Ray Stark never liked to get a no out of anybody. I think this is all in my mind, that Ray called John Huston to play Daddy Warbucks. That's my theory. And because he would have been a wonderful Daddy Warbucks. And Mr. Huston didn't want to do it. So Ray, not wanting to get a no, said, well, then how about directing it?
Right.
That's my theory.
Right.
You know, but he
and
was
And Finney did the movie.
Finney did the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Tim Curry and Bernadette Peters. We were the villains, the three villains. And I love doing it. I love doing something that was just great fun was we would sing live. I sang Little Girls live. It was not pre-recorded. The orchestra was pre-recorded.
So you were lip-syncing.
I was not lip-syncing.
So they would play
the
music
for
you to sing to?
And I sang.
They played a track and you sang live.
And I sang live. And,
it's a great number. You and him doing, you doing that and him doing Easy Street.
Right.
How was John to work with?
Never mind. Two takes, that's it, print.
That's it.
Yeah. He knew what he wanted.
He had the right people.
Yeah, one of the funniest pieces of direction I ever got was when I went to him and I said, I talked to him. I said, you know, I think she should drink. Because she's
really drink.
I mean, yeah, right. That she should have a little, you know, knock them back every so often because she's miserable, you know, and hates these kids and so forth. So the only kind of solace she gets is to knock them back a little bit, you know. And so he said, well, that's a very good idea, dear. Yes, that's good. And so I said, okay, so I'm not going to play her drunk, but I'm going to play her like she, you know, she kind of.
She needs one.
She needs one. And so the first scene was with Hannigan and the secretary who's coming in to get Annie, you know. And so I said, Mr. Hugh, call me John, dear. Mr. Hugh, John, how do you see this? How do you want me to do? He said, just cavort, dear.
Just cavort.
I had, we finished, we wrapped, but what they did, they made a big mistake. They filmed Easy Street with 400 dancers and singers on the Easy Street with a monkey grinder. And we would jump on fire escapes and jump all around. It just was overkill. At that time, they spent $1 million on that one number. It took a week to shoot. And Tim and Bernadette, and I said, this is just, it should just be the three villains in the orphanage because that's the way it was in the original. They are killing this song. So it wrapped. So I went back to Honolulu, and I had a procedure done on my chin. I had always wanted a bit because I had a weak chin, and so I this oral surgeon
put an implant.
No, he pulled it. Somehow he pulled this out 3 millimeters.
You didn't have the full John DeLorean implant.
No implant. Okay. So I had a little more of a chin, which I felt was good. It wasn't Kirk Douglas. It was just a little more of a chin. Okay, so I had that done by this oral surgeon in Honolulu. Now, 2 months later, I get a call from Ray Stark. We're going to reshoot the Easy Street number. I said, well, that's great. I said, but Ray, you know, now I have a chin. And he said, oh, and I explained it to him. And he said, oh, with all that Hannigan drag, you know, you're not going to worry about it. Also, it's not going to be picture to picture. It'll be a totally separate thing. But we're just going to do it with the three of you in the orphanage. And I said, great. So we all flew back and we report to work. And there's John Huston sitting here and so forth. And we're going to shoot it. And he said, well, this is what I want to do. He said, I would like to take it from when Carol ran into the closet to get Annie's locket, when she comes back out, that's where we'll pick it up. And I thought, uh-oh. So I went up and I said, Mr. Hugh, call me John. Mr. Houston, 2 months ago, when I ran into the closet, I didn't have a chin.
Right. And now I'm ready to do Lonely Are the Brave.
Exactly. Now you're picking up where I come out of the closet and I have a chin. I just thought I would call that to your attention. And here is what he said. He thought and thought and he said, oh, well, dear, then just come out looking determined. Is that a great piece of direction?
I'm going to remember that. That's clever. I want to say this. You know who you are to all of us who grew up watching TV then? And I can say to you from the bottom of my heart and without equivocation, what people think of when they think of you is you are the most talented woman that was ever on TV. You're the most talented woman that was ever on TV. You really are. Because there's a lot of people who are like you and they did some things that were great, but none of them did as much as you did, as well as you did.
Oh, wow, thank you.
And had the warmth and the sweetness and the nut and the insanity. I mean, I'm assuming there's some therapist out there who must know something about you out there in Beverly Hills. We won't get into that. But you are the most talented woman that was ever on TV, ever.
Well, excuse me, I've got to go now and buy a bigger hat.
Just look determined.
Just look determined.
Just look determined today, dear.
Just cavort.
Just cavort out there in New York.
I'm so glad we had this time together. Just to have a laugh or sing a song.
If you've seen The Carol Burnett Show, then you recognize this tune. Carol ended her show each week singing this song that her former husband and then producer wrote for her. The Screen Actors Guild will bestow the 2015 Life Achievement Award upon Carol Burnett early next year. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts.